Hello, this is Christian Okoye, former Kansas City Chiefs. You are listening to Grilling Truth.
Welcome to the Grilling Truth NFL Legends Show, brought to you by Gridiron Mo, an interactive football app where you get to call what you think the offense or defense should do during a live NFL game and see what all other fans have called also. Check out Gridiron Mo at www.gridironmo.com. I'm your host for the Legends Show, Mike Goodpaster, and I want to welcome in my co-host, Matt Andrews-Gavage.
Thanks, Mike. Very excited to be here. Very excited about our guest tonight.
Yeah, our guest was one of the best running backs of the decade of the 1980s. Three-time Pro Bowl running back for the Seattle Seahawks, helped lead Penn State to Joe Paterno's first ever national championship. Help us welcome to the Grueling Truth, Seahawk legend, Kurt Warner.
Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Thanks for the invite.
Well, great to have you on. So we'll just start at the beginning. Tell us a little bit about how you started playing football and who some of your early influences were.
Well, you know, there's such a thing called sandlot football. I think that's kind of where it started, on the gridiron of Wyoming grade school. It was a combination of dirt and asphalt, and that's kind of where we honed our skills. So that it goes back a long ways.
Now, you went to Pineville High. You want to talk a little bit about your time there?
Well, you know, I tell people about Pineville High. We had a graduating class of about 90 people. So that kind of tells you a little bit about the area. It's a coal mining town. And my old man was a coal miner for close to 40 years. So that's just kind of how it was. And that's pretty much what the community sort of evolved around, was the coal mining community.
All right. Now, I know a lot of times it's hard to get recruited from a smaller school. What led you to attending Penn State?
Well, it was a combination of a number of things. Number one, I was having a pretty good senior season, which I think was unexpected on a number of fronts. But, you know, it was just kind of one of those things where, you know, the week in and week out, I was performing at a very high level, and it started getting some attention. My English teacher, a lady by the name of Libby McKinney, was my English teacher at that time, and little did she know that she was going to become my PR person back then. And she kind of helped me fill out some of the questionnaires that these colleges were sending to and from, because I kind of got tired of that, and she kind of took the ball from there and ran with it. And being that she was an English teacher, she reached out to Coach Paterno, and from there things kind of evolved. So they came down, and along with a number of other colleges, and that's kind of when it began.
Well, you mentioned Coach Paterno. You know, what was your relationship like with him, and what was it like to play for him?
Well, as far as playing for Coach Paterno, he was a very driven, sort of matter-of-fact kind of guy who, you know, talked about Penn State and how we play and what was expected of us and, you know, the plain uniforms, and there's a reason as to why we do certain things, and, you know, we want to do things the right way. On the football field and off of the football field, he talked a lot about the grand experience, which dealt with playing great football, going to classes, and being good citizens.
And all right, now when you were there, the one thing that stood out to me when I was younger, I was probably 7th, 8th grade when you were, you know, playing at Penn State, was the rivalry you guys had with Pittsburgh. I know the rivalry kind of died off after you left there. Pitt had some rough times, but you want to tell everybody what the rivalry was like with Pittsburgh?
Oh, it was like the Hatfields and McCoys with regards to, you know, the rivals. You had the, you know, the western part of Pennsylvania, that was Pittsburgh, and on the other side you had Philadelphia, and you had guys going to both schools, no matter geographically where they were from. So, you know, it was just a combination of things. And as you, you know, my freshman year, as you hear about it and the things it's talked about, you never really understand the magnitude of it until you actually get out there and start playing. And it gets personal because you got families that are, you know, intertwined, intermingled, and some have gone to Pitt, some have gone to Penn State, and some were, you know, Steeler fans, some were Eagle fans, some were, you know, Panther fans, and some were Nittany Lion fans. So it's pretty interesting, the whole setup.
Well, you know, the 1982 Sugar Bowl, you know, being the first national championship for Penn State, that had to be pretty special. What was that like for you, and maybe some other some of your favorite college memories?
Well, you know what, we had worked extremely hard to get an opportunity to play in that game. I mean, that was years of going, you know, 11-1, 10-2, and et cetera, et cetera, and being in the right place at the right time, playing the right schedule, winning the games that you needed to win, and just hoping that you were going to get a shot at it. And we were just fortunate enough to, or unfortunately enough to get beat in the middle of the year. And then we were able to sort of work our way back into it mid-year, and kind of inch our way back into the rankings. And finally, that last week, there were a couple of teams that got beat, and we continued to win, and we were able to get back into that number two slot.
Yeah, and that Sugar Bowl was a great game. I think Georgia, I think they had Herschel Walker still then.
Yeah.
It was you kind of matching up with Herschel Walker. I know Greg Garrity, I think, made the great catch at the end of the game. You want to talk a little bit about that game?
Well, there was a lot of excitement going into the game. Obviously, there was Herschel Walker, who was the Heisman Trophy winner. And, you know, I think they were the favorites. And from our perspective, that wasn't the case in our minds. We heard a whole lot of Georgia fans, you know, making the comments about how about them dogs, how about them dogs, and that was sort of the verbiage back then, and I think they probably still say it today, but when you hear it, you know, 100 times or more throughout the week, and, you know, by the time game time had come around, we were pretty much ready to go. So, you know, and that was kind of the gist of the story. We were able to get in there and pull it out and make some great plays at the end of the game to do that. So, you know, we were crowned the national champions.
Well, moving forward a little bit to the 83 draft. Now, that draft class is widely regarded as one of the finest, if not the finest in history. What was your draft day experience like, especially for you going third overall?
You know what? At that particular time, I didn't really, you know, because we didn't have the big draft day where you see things evolving in the NFL today, and you got Roger Goodell and ESPN and so on and so forth. It was a lot, you know, less stressful, I guess, or you didn't have the big arena around you and so on and so forth. So for me, it was pretty straightforward. My agent was Marvin Dimoff, obviously. He was John Elway's agent, Dan Marino's agent, and a few other people in that draft class. So I had a pretty good idea as to where, you know, what was going on, because Marvin obviously kept me in the loop. But you know, I guess, you know, after all was said, I had a pretty good idea that I was going to go number three. They were going to be, Seattle was going to move up because they were at number nine, and I didn't think they were going to go up that far to do that, but, you know, with Coach Knox being the coach at the time and being that he likes to run the football, so it just kind of sized up that way, and we were able to connect.
All right, now your rookie season, you had a great season. You ran for almost 1,500 yards, 13 touchdowns. When you got to camp there and with that Seahawk team, was there anybody that kind of took you under their wing and helped you out?
No, not really. You're a rookie, and you get treated as a rookie. I was telling a guy today about my rookie year with the Seahawks, and you know, it's basically like starting all over, and you're going to get treated a certain way. So, you know, the rookies kind of hung together, but you know, they like to haze you, and they like to make you do things, but it's all a part of being a part of the team. So you just gotta deal with it. And that's kind of how it was and how it went. So
now, one of the best games that I've ever seen was from your rookie season, the 51-48 back and forth overtime game against Kansas City, which you ran for over 200 yards and 3 touchdowns. You want to tell us a little bit about that great game?
Well, there wasn't a whole lot of defense being played that day, but you had two teams that were pretty evenly matched, and we put a lot of points on the board, and they put a lot of points on the board, and we were able to to win that one. But it was a hard fought game, and I was able to make a sizable contribution on that Sunday, and I was very pleased to play as well as I did.
Now, the 1983 Seahawks were one of the best teams in franchise history. You guys were only 9-7 in the regular season. You win at the end of the season to get in, blow out Denver, have a huge upset in Miami. You want to talk a little bit about what made that team so special and maybe talk a little bit about the playoff run?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, obviously I think Coach Knox had a lot to do with the mindset, the toughness, the breaking down some of those stereotypes. Because, you know, Seahawks had a lot of talent when I got there. So it was just finding that combination of coaching and motivation and play calling and all of those things that we needed to do to get us on the right track. And I think it just evolved as the season progressed. And, you know, like I said, they had there was a lot of guys that were talented. And I think with Coach Knox and so on and so forth, and then you change the mindset and the attitude, and lo and behold, you know, we're sort of the underdog, the Cinderella story. You know, everybody likes that Cinderella story, and we were able to, you know, to come into that arena being somewhat labeled as the underdog. We were able to make a run, and we weren't surprised, in my opinion, that things were happening the way they were. We knew we were a good football team. It just a matter of executing at the right times.
Well, you know, as amazing as the playoff run was, you got the loss to the Raiders in the championship game, disappointing end of the season. As great as 83 was, 84 had to be just that much tougher for you when the injury happened. Can you tell us a little bit about that injury and what it took to get back on the field for the 85 season?
Oh man. It was something that, you know, I had never experienced before, and that is a major, you know, career-ending type of injury. And, you know, it was just, okay, it happened. I really didn't understand the significance of it. And I was fortunate enough to have an orthopedic surgeon by the name of you know, Dr. Scranton, Dr. Pierce Scranton, who was extremely talented at what he was doing. So, you know, during that whole process, he and I talked a few times. I mean, obviously, I was somewhat depressed about being hurt, not being able to play. But he said to me that, hey, you know what, I've done my job with regards to repairing your knee, and basically I need you to do your job, and that is to get out there and rehab and get back on the football field. And that was sort of my mindset. There were a lot of – it was a long process. I mean, it took, you know, a year or so to get back on the field. And then it took about half of that season before I kind of really felt, you know, comfortable with it again. And it was a game against, we were back east playing someone. I can't remember. I don't know if it was the Redskins or someone. And I had this brace on, and I hated that brace on my knee. And it broke. The brace kind of snapped because of usage, and I just threw it. I threw it away. I said, you know what? I'm not wearing this brace anymore. And then two plays later, I get hit on the knee again, and I got up, and it was kind of like, you know, those shackles had kind of, and that's not the, probably not the right word, but the ball and chain had sort of been lifted, and then from there, I was dialed in after that. So, you know, so it was a long, tough process, but I thank the good Lord that I was able to get through it.
All right. Now, your coach almost your entire career was Coach Knox. I mean, it's got to be great for a running back to go to a place where the coach is known, or his nickname is Ground Chuck.
Yeah.
I mean, what was it like to play for him? What was your relationship with him?
Well, obviously, you know, Chuck, he had a kind of a tough guy type of mentality, you know, like, you know, the first thing he said to us in our first meeting was, Seahawk football, tougher, smarter, better condition, a hard man kind of comes down the hard road. You got to play like guy's got his hand in your back pocket. A lot of Knoxisms, you know, that kind of stuff. and we could go on and on and on with the Knoxisms, but that was sort of his mindset. You know, he's pretty conservative. Let's not beat ourselves, and let's make the plays when we need to make the plays. And that was sort of our mentality.
Well, Seahawks fans would probably say that you played on the during the golden age of Seahawks football, the 1980s. You had mentioned before a lot of talented players. One player that I'd like to ask about is, what was it like to play with the great Steve Largent?
Well, you couldn't find a more competitive guy than Steve Largent, a guy who worked hard, a guy off the field that was a family guy, but he was as tough of a football player as I've ever played with. So, you know, he can make the plays when we needed to make plays, and the guy could run routes like nobody's business. So it wasn't a fluke. You know, he was probably one of the best route runners I've seen. And I've had the privilege of watching in practice and in the games.
All right, you went through the 1987 season. We had this players' strike. What are your recollections of the players' strike, and do you think it worked out for the players, or do you think it ended up more for the owners?
That's a good question. Well, let me ask you this. Are you watching what's going on with the NBA?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and we're still not being paid adequately with regards to the NBA players, when everyone knows that the big boy in town is the NFL, right?
Yeah.
Right.
At least we like to think so. I mean, so there obviously there are people who would probably disagree with that, and rightfully so.
Well, the NFL's TV ratings blow away the NBA, and so does the television contract.
No doubt.
And baseball the same way. But obviously there's something to this that's not working correctly. I don't want to get into the ifs and buts about it, but I think the players' union needs to do a better job of representing the players. That's just my personal opinion.
Yeah, we've talked to a lot of players, and everybody believes that. So.
Yeah, and for good reason, because maybe we need to go get their guys and have them negotiate the contracts for the NFL guys. The NBA.
Well, I believe at one point in the early 80s, the NFL, I mean, I think they were, Marvin Miller was talked about as being the ones to help them. He's the one to put baseball over the top after the 81 strike. But for some reason, he never came aboard.
Yeah, well, I don't know, and I have, no idea as to what was going on behind the scenes, but obviously it seems to be working well for the other guys, and rightfully so. Hey, you know what? It's business, and they're managing their business better than we are at this particular juncture, in my opinion.
All right, Matt.
As you look back on your career, is there anything that you would have done differently, or are you pretty much satisfied with all the choices that you made during your career?
Well, I mean, there's always things you could look back on and say, I should have done this or could have done things differently. I would have liked to have played on more grass. I think AstroTurf should have been outlawed from the beginning.
Yeah, especially AstroTurf from the 80s.
Oh, the AstroTurf from the 80s, just like playing on concrete. That's basically what it was. And that should have never been allowed. Again, it goes back to the union. Okay, we're not playing on this stuff. This is detrimental to one's career. We shouldn't have been playing on that stuff. Regardless, let's play outside. Well, okay, we build a dome. No, let's build a field outside as well. Let's play on that stuff because that was not good stuff to play on for one's career anyway.
Yeah, and the owners obviously didn't care, and they prove it by their treatment of the former players with the CTE and everything else that's been going on.
Well, yeah, and you could talk about a whole different segment just on that part of it. So, it's unfortunate, but, you could go around and be upset and be angry about it, but it's unfortunately or fortunately, it's business, and it's big business. And these guys are smart for a reason. They're smart businessmen, and they're shrewd businessmen to a certain degree. And they're going to do what's best for the business of football. And unfortunately, we haven't matched that level of intensity, nor have we matched the level of dealing with them in that same manner. So. And the NFL is a league that, unfortunately or fortunately, it is a league that that's always in the moment. It's always in the moment.
Yeah.
And when you're in that, and when you're in your arena and you can play, then you're in the moment. But as soon as you're not able to play, you're not going to be in the moment, and you won't become. You're just going to be on the outside looking in. No matter how you look at it. So it's a great game. I hope that we can get some of these things fixed with regards to the players that are not playing. But in the meanwhile, it is going to continue to thrive, and it's going to continue to gain popularity.
Yeah, and I think the biggest problem with that is basically, when you're 25 years old and you're in the NFL, you don't think that you're ever not going to be playing.
Ah, you just said it right there. You just said it. You have said it 100%.
So, I mean, there's no reason to worry about when you retire if you think you're going to play forever.
You think you're going to play forever and you're invincible and you're unable to comprehend what's going to happen in the next 3 to 5 years. You just can't see it until somebody smacks you across the face and say, wake up. Here's how it's going to work. You're not going to listen to it.
Yeah, and the problem is the NFL is like any other big corporation anymore. They could care less about their workers as long as they're making their profit.
I would have to agree with you on that. As long as they're making their money and the guys are in there currently doing what they're supposed to do. And again, it goes back to the, in my opinion, the union has got to educate the current players as to what is going to happen. And unfortunately, the guys who are outside looking in, we're not going to be able to get in, nor are they going to be, they're going to listen. So same thing, it's the same boat we were in. Unfortunately, it's the same thing we did.
Yeah, and now they're starting to do a little bit of stuff, but they only do it because public opinion forces them to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then you have individual players who are in that same mindset, whereas it's never going to end, and they don't want to hear it, and they're being isolated, and they're going to listen to what they're being told by the union, and I think, you know, unfortunately, the union is not delivering on the full message, the entire message.
It's a shame that more. Oh, go ahead, Mike.
Go ahead, Matt.
I was just going to say it's a shame that, you know, players can't. Today's players, you know, this should be facilitated by the union. Can't hear from, you know, players like you and other former players that know what's coming, and to be able to better educate these young guys to get them better prepared.
Well, our union won't even invite us to do any of this stuff. I'm sure there are a lot of guys that would love to go in and tell these guys, hey, you know what, let me give you some reality here. Number one, you're not going to play forever. Number two, you're going to be where I am today. Number three, I was there where you were. Same mindset, same mentality. I got the credentials to back it up, et cetera, et cetera. So listen to me. What I'm telling you, this is kind of what you need to be prepared for. I'm not saying that they're all bad. I'm not saying that they're all good. But here's what you need to be aware of. So, and if you need to talk about, you know, what you think you want to do when it's all said and done, there's a lot of guys that would be happy to give them advice on what they can do and what they should do. So,
right.
But
and the thing that you really got to wonder is this. Who's in the union's ear so they don't do what they're supposed to do? And what's going on there?
Excuse me?
I said the big thing to me is who's in the union's ear and why aren't they doing everything they can to help the former players?
You know what? I have no idea. I have no idea why the union isn't looking beyond the current situation, because they're living in the union, or they're living in the moment as well. The union is living in the moment. So, you know, if it's not broke, you know, don't mess with it. Don't fix it. Well, it is broke. And some guys find out the hard way that it's broke. And then some guys, you know, obviously aren't going to have to worry about that as much as others. But I guarantee you this, there are more on the other side, on the outside looking in, than those who are completely just sort of going to walk away and everything is going to be, you know, dialed in for them. So, but you know what? Again, I can't say anything because I was there in their position, in their slot, and you don't know what you don't know, and in a lot of cases, you just don't know. You just plead ignorance. But there shouldn't be ignorance involved in the process, because there should be dialogue between those who are who have played and those who are playing. There should be some dialogue between those two groups to say, hey, you know, there's more guys looking in than more guys that are playing. You got, what, 20,000 or so NFL alumni, and you have currently, what, how many, I don't know, 1,900, 1,800 guys that are in the league or something of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of guys there.
Way it would change is if you get guys that are playing like Tom Brady, Peyton Manning, the guys that are making the big money to stand up and actually say something, but they won't because they're making their money.
There you go. And they don't have to at this particular juncture because, you know, they're going to be, you know, they've had great careers and they've been very successful and they're going to continue to be successful, period. And so I don't think anybody's knocking that. I just, you know, there's other guys that have not been so successful, but have had great careers as well. So.
Yeah. All right. So what keeps you busy these days?
Well, you know, I've got a family. I have four kids. I've got my oldest son is attending Penn State University. I've got twin boys with autism, so that keeps us fairly busy. And then we have a 10-year-old little girl, and she keeps us very busy. So it's a combination of a number of things.
Well, Matt, you got any final questions for Kurt?
Not a question. I'd just like to say that it was an honor to speak to you today, and I really appreciate you coming by. And thank you for all the great memories. You were a great player to watch. I remember watching you, and it's definitely an honor to have you on our show.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed the conversation. You guys do a great job of asking the right questions. You give us an opportunity to talk about things, and you know that's appreciative. So thank you.
All right, Kurt. I just want to echo what Matt said. I'm a little bit older than Matt, so I think I remember your playing career slightly better because Matt's not as old as me. But, I remember the 83 playoff run. I'm still pissed off y'all lost to the Raiders, but yeah, it happens. But you were a great running back.
We still are. You know, although we're in different conferences now, we still don't like the Raiders regardless. So
yeah, and I was always a Penn State fan, and I remember those. And I think I remember Pitt and Penn State used to play the day after Thanksgiving, maybe.
Yep. It was in that. That was right at that. Yeah, it was either the. I don't think it was the day of, but it was like that week, that Saturday after Thanksgiving.
Yeah, it was either the Friday or Saturday after. I think it's 79. Yep. It was like the Friday after, and the other years it was like the Saturday after. But I remember watching those games, always cheering for Penn State because I'm a Bengals fan, so anything from Pittsburgh I hate. So that includes the Pitt Panthers, the Penguins, and all that crap. So I always figure, you know, there's probably a bunch of Steeler fans there, and I don't want them assholes to be happy. So.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of Steeler fans. There's no doubt about that.
But, hey, thanks again for coming on. We'd love to have you back sometime. I know we do an NFL Pick'em show weekly where we have guys come on and pick the games with us if you'd be interested in doing that.
Sure, why not?
All right.
I love
well, you, that way you can, you know, you can also beat Matt like I always do.
No.
Even though we tied last year. But
he's not giving you the whole story there, but that's
right. Well, I just admitted we tied. So, but, all right, thanks a lot, Kurt. Guys, make sure you check out The Grueling Truth at thegruelingtruth.net. We will have former Pittsburgh Steeler Dwight Stone on the show Thursday night. Tomorrow night we'll have the Gridarmo Super Bowl trivia show, where me and Matt will battle again. We're tied in that, too, 5 each, Matt, so that's a big show week. Make sure you check out the CFL Pick'em show I did today with Brian Schmidt and former running back Robert Drummond, 4-time Grey Cup winner. And next Monday we'll start doing the CFL Grey Cup or the CFL Weekly Pick'em show with myself, Brian Schmidt, Robert Drummond and CFL Hall of Fame quarterback Dieter Brock. He will join us on Monday night. Make sure you check out GridIronMo at www.gridironmo.com. Follow us at The Grilling Truth. So for Matt Andrews-Scavage, Kurt Warner, I'm Mike Goodpaster. You've been listening to The Grueling Truth, where the legends speak.